Hi everyone, Lucas Werner here. If you've been enjoying these conversations with artists, I invite you to come visit David's Werner Gallery exhibitions in person. We're located in New York, Los Angeles, London, Paris, and Hong Kong. New exhibitions open each month. Plan your visit at davidswerner.com.
From David's Werner, this is Dialogues, a podcast about artists and the way they think.
It's the handwork to make the surface more cherry, more beautiful than a factory could ever make it because of the layers and using those techniques, surfboard techniques, lacquer techniques, all the artist techniques that make it glow and feel the depth and layers of color.
He's trying so hard to move past his own avoidance and approach it so that he can make his work and make it true to him. I've never really heard an artist sort of like walk themselves towards something that they were so scared of.
I'm Helen Molesworth, your host for this season. Every episode features a conversation with artists, curators, writers, designers, philosophers, filmmakers, and musicians about what it means to make things today. Hey everybody, it's Helen. I'm coming to you today with a fun live episode we taped in the garden at David's Werner Los Angeles, prompted by an amazing exhibition of John McCracken sculptures. McCracken, a quintessential West Coast artist, was a major figure in minimalism, and this exhibition seemed like a great opportunity to see what minimalism, a dominant art movement of the 20th century, looks like from our 21st century vantage point. My guests were Michael Govan, the director of the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, and the LA-based artist Colleen Smith. We had a blast, and I really hope you enjoy it.
We are coming to you live from David's Werner in Los Angeles, where there is a John McCracken exhibition currently on view. This is McCracken's first solo exhibition in Los Angeles in 20 years. When I realized it was the first show in 20 years, it seemed like a good opportunity to gather and talk about this work and this really extraordinary body of work. And the two people in town that I immediately thought that I wanted to talk to were Michael Govan, the director of LACMA. But before he was the director of LACMA, he was the director at DIA and kind of gave us DIA Beacon, which is, although he just said to me he doesn't believe in minimalism, I would argue is the temple to the thing he does not believe in, minimalism. And the other person I wanted to talk to was Colleen Smith. And I wanted to talk to Colleen because I just think you're such a good artist. And I kind of wanted to hear you about another artist who I think is such a good artist, John McCracken. So just a little background on McCracken. He was born in 1934, died in 2011. He developed his early sculptural work while studying painting at the California College of Arts and Crafts in Oakland in the late 50s and early 60s. While he experimenting with increasingly three-dimensional canvases, he began to create objects made with industrial materials, including plywood, sprayed lacquer, and pigmented resin, resulting in the highly reflective, smooth surfaces for which he would become known. And I hope that you will get the opportunity to walk around and experience those McCracken sculptures, their extraordinary liquidity, the way they kind of come in and out of focus. You understand they have a really sharp edge, and you take a step and that sharp edge all of a sudden isn't there anymore. So these were all of the kinds of things that McCracken was very, very interested in. He was very interested in California car culture, particularly car finishes, what we would now call finish fetish, you know, which is a very kind of California version of things. But now I want to drop into minimalism as the big M minimalism. I think like almost all of us in this audience, minimalism comes to us fully formed. We arrive and it has an East Coast posse and a West Coast posse. We understand that it came with an extraordinary written record. Almost all of the minimalist artists engaged in some kind of writing about their own work. And then there's a very intense critical dialogue. The major art historians and critics of the time all feel that they must grapple with this material. And so there's a sense that minimalism comes to us as a set of practitioners, a body of objects, and an intellectual discourse, all kind of very fulsome. It's kind of hard to overstate its dominance in the 60s and 70s. There's one of my favorite David Anton quotes, which I don't know if it's true, I'm looking to Michael, but apparently someone goes up to David Anton at a party and says, "What you been up to?" And he says, "I've been waiting for minimalism to die." Right? So this kind of, on the one hand, it's hallowed ground, and on the other hand, there's a sort of antipathy toward it because it is so strong a movement, and its influences are felt for so long. It's known for objects with a kind of cool appearance, its emphasis on a reduced form or a reduction of forms. Minimalism also comes to us with an overwhelming framework of negation. I am not a sculpture and I am not a painting. I am an object, right? This desire to refute categories is part of what it does. The other thing it is, though, and I think this is really maybe for me as an art historian, the meat of the matter, is that it also comes with a really robust philosophical discourse, because these guys and the critics that are writing about them, they're reading Merleau-Ponty. So they're reading a lot of phenomenology. And for those of you who are feeling rusty on your history of Western thought, you will recall that phenomenology is what we get when we need to get out of the Enlightenment. So if Descartes gives us, "I think, therefore I am," phenomenology gives us, "I perceive, therefore I exist," right? And that was a way of calling out for a viewer that would be really embodied, right? When you look at minimal sculpture, you're in a body, you're moving around. So that's a really big conceptual philosophical shift. Then the other thing about minimalism is that it opens the door for a lot that happens afterwards. Because so many minimal objects took so seriously themselves as an event in the room became important. The museum became important. So minimalism is something that opens out into installation art. It opens out into institutional critique, right? It opens the door for how we think also about who is this viewer who is in the galleries preambulating around these objects. McCracken has a really special place in this pantheon. His signature plank form is kind of nearly perfect in its reduction. He thought about color as a material, so he was interested in a density of color in the object that would play with your sense of perception. The plank uses both the wall and the floor. I love the tenderness of a McCracken on the wall like that. I find it very gentle. They're 8 feet high, so they're neither monumental nor strictly anthropomorphic. They're in some weird, not quite human scale, but not human scale. And unlike all the other minimalists, McCracken is not at all afraid of the word beautiful. In fact, it's a word he uses often in his writing, and he really wanted his objects to be beautiful. He was really interested in UFOs. He believed that he himself had experienced time travel. He said, "Physical reality is big, but inner reality, though slippery, is bigger. And it permits time travel, as does the mind." He was interested in ancient Egypt. He said, "I was trying to get clarity, conciseness, and effectiveness in the work." He asked himself, quote, "What works would I make if I were a visitor from another world?" All right, so Michael, you are known for an amazing presentation of minimalism that's almost permanently on view at Diabecum. And you are also known in the field as someone who's trying to reinvent the so-called encyclopedic museum. And I love the twinning of these two things. And I told you this recently. I remembered you telling me that you worked with Robert Irwin to design the building. And I guess I wanted to ask you if you could just talk a little bit about, one, what is your experience of installing those objects? Because you have such an intimacy with all of those people and installing that work. I'm curious how minimalism has affected not only your sense of art, but like really how you present art, how you imagine putting things in space for a viewer.
Thanks, Helen. And Colleen is a great artist, so it's great that she's here. That's the main thing. Colleen, even your installations, the whole idea that we have of installation art, I remember there was a comment written about Dan Flavin's work at one point when I had the retrospective, which came to LA, and there's a famous piece from 66. And I know there are other origins. We can think of Wojtasik and others, but it said he invented installation art for better or for worse. This idea was it a curse that these artists were so interested in space? And I just had to install a show of Flavin and Judd. And, you know, Judd is like that idea. It's like a Japanese rock garden where if it's two objects are too far away, there's no energy. If they're too close, they crowd. And then there's a kind of sweet spot. And there's this energy between things. And so I think a lot of us have been educated, whether we know it or not, in our art worlds, by the notion that everything matters in our spatial environment. Everything matters. The fact that it's the wall and the floor, and you're so conscious of that, and how I'm a crack and leans with its weight and gravity lets it do that. And yes, it does look like a surfboard on the, you know, in your on your wall. And so I think that the exciting thing about that is that, I mean, the positives of that are the openness to paying attention to everything. And to being aware of one's surroundings and how to read the surroundings, that the surroundings are part of the thing you're reading. So that very much goes together. Irwin was, I do say he, among the others of the group, were teachers, and they would pay attention to everything. And I think there's also a notion that is very, it's funny you put them together, very relevant to this reinvention of an encyclopedic museum, that, you know, a lot of what's cool about it is that you can put almost any of the, especially East Coast minimalists' work, and I'm just using the name for you. I would tear minimalism apart for you if you'd like.
Go for it.
As you can phrase everything in terms of a question. You know, what is a painting? What is gravity? What is space? What does it mean not to have a, why would you have a pedestal? Like, what does a pedestal mean? What is the relationship between the wall and the floor? And so this idea of a constant questioning, you can walk through Diabekan and you can phrase everything not in terms of a statement, but a question. And that's an incredible way to just go about your day. And so I think the other thing is, and that's told because you'll often see one of these artists or McCracken in a space by itself with lots of other things, and you're like, oh, that's kind of quirky and weird, this standing monolith or whatever. But when you see a lot of them, and you can see a whole room of Robert Ryman or whatever, and you realize, oh, it's not white. There's no such thing as, there's just 1,000 colors. There's a rainbow of colors and layers and materials. Ryman would always say he's the only realist painter because he's the only one who dealt with like the real screws that attach the painting, and he was aware of all those things. And so I guess for me, that's the biggest inspirational part, is that the whole world can be seen in terms of those questions, and therefore you're paying attention to everything, and therefore even the museum, and I can read every space in that way, since it's been, those spaces have been dissected and, you know, thought about.
So do you think in the reinstallation at LACMA, do you think that some of that energy will be at play? I mean, you know, how does the person who's installed more minimalist work than anyone else reinstall an encyclopedic museum?
Well, the museum will be installed by our 45 curators with a little back and forth and conversation. But to sort of structure space, for example, I mean, there's so many ways to read things. A closed space is different from an open space where you see in and you see out. Transparency is extremely meaningful. The museum is all horizontal, mostly like Dia Beacon is, so that there is, and there's no front, no back, no up, no down. So it's entirely non-hierarchical. These are thoughts that came directly from conversations with, you know, Robert Irwin about the nature of how you feel in a space and how you, I mean, this is what all the California artists taught you, is like your half of everything is your perception into a space, not what you receive. You come to everything with yourself, which is a lot, and so you meet everything halfway. And so if you do that, you can read everything from what do steps mean and how do you rise or fall or what's flat and what's multi-story, what's front, what's back, what's transparent, what's not. And so the idea was to set, as you know, Irwin would say, conditional, to set conditions for a certain kind of seeing and paying attention to all that.
Okay, Colleen, I think many of us see you as someone who started out as a filmmaker. And then you do lots of things. You make drawings, you make sculptures, you make ceramics, you make fabric work. But you're increasingly, it seems to me, known for these highly atmospheric installations. They're lush with color and texture. They have a kind of what I would call trippy California vibe, which I realize is not a precise art historical phrase, but I feel like
it's in the dictionary.
It's in the dictionary, right? Trippy California vibe. 100%. There's a picture of your installation, I think, right there at the Webster's. But it seems to me that the central problem that you've been circling around, your work has been circling around, is how do we imagine a future out of this rather spectacularly ruinous present that we live in? I realized, thinking about you, that I think of you as a maximalist. Like, you're like, oh, and then there could be another rug, and we could ask Michelle to make a record, and we could let the viewers put on the record themselves. You know, like you just, your iteration of your own work goes on and on and on. I guess I just wanted to ask you about McCracken, because when I walked into that room and I saw that field, I thought, this is like a Colleen Smith installation, except with no video, no rugs, no music. Like, there's just something, but my feeling is really similar. Like, I'm in and out, my sense of vision is expanding, my sense of my body is getting incredibly weird. And then, of course, there's UFOs and transcendental thinking, which I think there's a lot of transcendental thinking in your work. So I wonder if you just want to talk about McCracken for a minute.
I'm so excited to do so. I think I had an epiphany about McCracken. Maybe 2011 or so, when I just kept walking, like doing this arc around one, I was leaning against the wall and I was totally tripping out. And I kept like trying to make myself disappear in it and then wait for myself to reappear. And then, and I didn't know how they were made. I didn't know what it was I was looking at. I didn't know. I am a trained filmmaker, and it's my friends, and I'm self-taught, and my friends taught me anything I know about art, so I have a lot to learn. So I didn't know what I was looking at. Then I just heard someone say, oh yeah, he buffs those out like surfboards, and I just heard like an aside, you know what I mean? And then I was just like, psh. It's like I was like, this artist is also from California, because this is the kind of like intense, like obsessive, like labor, that buffing that you would do on a lowrider or something like that, but you do it so that it looks easy. You do it so that it looks effortless. You do it so that no one knows you did it. Like, that just really floored me. I was just kind of, I had to stop and think about that, like that, and that there was for me a recognition in that. And that I associate that somehow with the West Coast. And I spent a summer teaching at Skowhegan one summer, and I saw this very clear coastal split in the painters in particular. Well, all of the New York painters, they might have like a really like chilled field, and then there'd be like a like a scrawl, like a mark, like violent mark. And then the California filmmakers were doing these crazy elaborate things, and then they would just like kind of like kick it in the corner and be like, yeah, that's the thing. I was like, I saw you working on that for like 4 days. Like, what is it doing balled up in the corner? Like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I thought, yeah, I don't know, and I still don't know what it is about this idea of like obsessively working and laboring on something to make a pretty, pretty thing, right? And then I'm just gonna lean against the wall. I don't know what to say about that, but I have an affinity with it that I think is really actually geographical. And then, in my excitement of trying to actually learn about McCracken so that I could speak to you about him, and I'm sorry, there's like so little I know. But like in that excitement, when I realized that, oh, this guy actually talks about UFOs, he talks about the paranormal, he talks about time travel. I listened to a recording of him, and he is about the same age as my parents. And I thought about that particular generation, which is a little bit in between other generations. And he had a really similar kind of like informality about his whole origin story himself. Like it's not important. You know what I mean? People keep trying to ask him stuff. He said something like, and this really touched me because I really do believe that, I can't prove this, but I think that people who are abducted by UFOs have experienced some kind of really profoundly disruptive trauma, right? And I don't say that as a judgment. I think it's something that creates like a glitch, and then they have this experience. And in one of the interviews, McCracken talked about moving around a lot because of his Army dad. Yeah. And he said, yeah, you know, a lot of kids, that would be like trauma for them. It would be like really trauma, but it wasn't for me. It's fine. And I was like, oh, that's so interesting. Because he brought up trauma and then said he didn't have any. And then he's talking about UFOs. And I was like, I wish you were still around. He'd be like my dad's age. He could come over for dinner. They could just sit in the backyard, long chairs. I could ask them both about UFOs. You know what I mean? And trauma.
So can we talk about the labor and the not labor? Yeah. Right. So I think that, because I do think that's part of the appeal of McCracken. You are looking at something that you don't know really quite how it's made, right? Because you don't understand perceptually how the edge is so hard and then disappears. You don't understand how this thing that has edges doesn't have seams, right? There's lots of opposites and binaries. You don't understand how it can be so perfect. But none of it, I mean, I wonder if what you're thinking about in terms of the labor is that it doesn't actually feel like a gimmick.
Very much so.
You know, like a gimmick is something that's like working too hard at not working very hard at all, right? And that's not what this is.
Oh, it's like, you know, like the idea of like utilizing these industrial processes, right? But kind of hijacking them away from function, use, even commodity into something.
Meditation.
Yeah.
Right? It's super meditative. Mm-hmm.
So you have this kind of surface that you expect in some expensive object that you would buy. Something that you would like purchase, like a car. Okay, so car, when you buy it, it's going to be sexy, wax, beautiful, shiny. You expect that from an industrial object. And I think that he took it out completely out of that. And it's not like taking a bunch of DuPont tiles and putting them on the ground. It's different from that. And I'm not trying to throw shade, though maybe I am, but it is like a kind of, I don't know, like a hijacking of these processes that do a lot in this realm that actually, when you go internal, are meaningless. And so how do you make something so completely like seductive, like desperately want to touch this, desperately want to look at it endlessly, And also be a little bit like, how did you make that? Which is how I feel about every made thing in the world. Like, how did they make that? How did they make this? I don't know. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But make it so that I'm not thinking about that anymore. What I'm thinking about is the fact that I lose myself in it. But then I see someone, another person appears behind me or next to me. And I just think, I don't know, there's just something incredibly generous about that, which is, I don't know anything about this argument about the term minimalism, but I do not think of these as minimal.
Mm. Can we push a little bit on the one hand, what Michael raises is they're meditative, and I think we feel the meditation in their making, right? That there's something obsessive in the making. And making and seeing. And then there's also what Colleen is describing, which is a quality of perception in which you can see yourself and you disappear, and then other people come in. And that doesn't feel like meditating to me, right? Like that feels like some kind of way of thinking about how we are together, right? And so I'm wondering if, is what McCracken is doing always holding these irresolvable things in an object that seems totally resolved?
Well, this one takes in its environment, but they all do, right? The idea of a shiny surface, they're not matte, as you move by them. I mean, we have one in the museum right now that's near the David Hockney, and it's kind of reflecting the David Hockney, and as you walk by it, the light changes. So they do take in their environment in that sense, and so they are always reacting to you, and of course they're changing their shape, some of them, as you're moving around them. So he is very space conscious. I mean, it's hard to look at this as handmade, but they also are handmade. It's not the car that comes out of the factory. It's the kid, like that Robert Irwin describes in talking about restoring cars. It's the handwork to make the surface more cherry, more beautiful than a factory could ever make it, because of the layers and using those techniques, surfboard techniques, lacquer techniques, all the artist techniques that make it glow and feel the depth and layers of color. Mm-hmm. And so I think that handmade quality is also very present. You can kind of tell it's not a machine, even though it's perfect. And I think that's a real interesting aspect of it. And it is sort of inspirational. The other fun, we got to install one. I couldn't help it, but we did a show on Stanley Kubrick, and Kubrick always said the monolith in 2001 was inspired by minimalism, so I couldn't help it. And we put a McCracken next to the big image of the monolith, and it kind of works the UFO angle, works the kind of from outer space angle. So there's a mysteriousness too in some of its lack of purpose. There aren't obvious reasons for its size or its shape or anything else. So it holds that too. So it holds a lot of things together, I think, in something that's simple, so it's not minimal.
I love talking about minimalism with people, because the first thing everyone wants to do is deny its existence as a category, which is good. It's very good for that. These ideas come to us from the 60s and 70s. Now it's, you know, we're in the 2020s. And there's a kind of art world truism at the moment that what we want our art to do is reflect us, right? That when we go to the museum, what we want is to see ourselves somehow reflected. That this is, you know, partly bound up in a current vogue for figurative painting, which I think we're all, you know, we know this. We go to galleries, we see these things. And I guess I wanted to talk a little bit about the ways in which minimalism, or McCracken's in specific, both reflect and don't reflect us. If you went into a museum looking for yourself, in some ways you could no more literally find yourself than in a McCracken, and you could no more literally not find yourself at all in a McCracken. Colleen, you've opened up the door to take an industrial thing and make it non-instrumental. So do they do what an art object is supposed to do, or do they do something in surfeit of what an art object is supposed to do? Do they satisfy the itch to see yourself, if that's your itch?
I think they just produce that argument about what is an object. I think that the way in which you see yourself in them, to me, has also something to do with seeing the maker of them. I love that when he's thinking about, if I were from an alien planet, what would I leave? And he leaves this mysterious object that he made, but you cannot perceive him. I just think that's an argument about what is an object beyond use, or also even in use. Like, what is an object? How do we look at it? How do we perceive it? Maybe I think for me the idea, the thing about figurative painting, as I probably shouldn't speak publicly about it. Yeah, so I'll leave it at that.
I hate it when they say they won't speak publicly about the thing I want them to speak publicly about. I must ask my question differently. If we're focusing on acts of perception, for both of you, does that somehow get us into a space of ethics and relation?
So that thing about reflecting yourself literally or not or whatever, but there's an aspect of all this work, this questioning aspect, which is also questioning your perception, right? Like it is about subjectivity and the problematics of subjectivity. You look at it and you think, oh, it's rectangle, it's objective, it's geometry. But really, the entire enterprise, all these artists, are about the complexities of subjectivity, how everything's conditional, seeing each situation is different. And so there is a sort of, meta politics about that, about being always aware of the problematics of that. And so I think it does keep the door open for lots of variations. I would dare not say, talk about universalism or anything like that, but there is a problematics of subjectivity. It can be around Merleau-Ponty a little bit or not. I mean, there were a lot of those artists who were definitely not into philosophy. Some were, and some just got it from pop philosophy and everyday life and drugs and all the other things they did. So it doesn't need to come from any kind of intellectual framework, but there's this kind of like, what am I seeing? And what does that mean about me? And how do I see things? And isn't that the issue around the world, is that people do have this, we're in it, experiencing it, projecting things into it. People see things differently.
So we have this body of work that we know in some way is about subjectivity. How, it doesn't announce itself as being about subjectivity. And in fact, a lot of minimalism, and perhaps even this, like what you're saying, Colleen, like he sweeps himself out of the room. Like he doesn't let you see any trace of the labor, and yet the labor is everywhere. He doesn't let you see him. You can only see you, but not really. I've got to ask it. I feel like we treat this work now like as canonical. So perhaps we treat it in ways where we assume that the questions have been stated and answered. But it seems to me one of the things that's happening here is that all the questions are still very much on the table. And I'm wondering how those questions, how you both think they might be made to be very alive for a generation that has come up with a very different version of the image and the object in space, which is not this version of the image and the object.
Well, by the way, most of the people are getting it from photographs of those objects, which are framed in a very narrow space, and they're not actually in space, and they're not seeing that the light is changing as you walk by it, or it incorporates you into it. And I think a lot of that is just how minimalism, in the sense that you're talking about, got framed by photography and by that kind of trade of geometry and all that stuff, instead of the problematic experience of, well, think about the empty space, which is a lot of it. I don't know why I'm thinking of you as a minimalist, but because you put everything in it, but there's somehow the lessons of like paying attention to everything, space, things are happening in different places, you're moving people's attention across a room and around, and then there are moments to sit and, you know, watch, and then you're, I don't know, it's they're not so far apart.
No.
And it's not, we're talking about figurative painting, but it's not like an image of something. Or a direct, and you stay, I mean, your narratives are, you know, you're using too many narratives overlaid in ways that are unexpected and hard to explain. And so you end up back at something that's a little bit abstract and complicated and hums like a meditation too.
Mm.
And you've got your, you know, disco ball throwing light from from everywhere in the stars and the cosmos. So I don't know, I can put you in that category somehow.
I mean, I think that's my relationship, and it definitely explains my, you know, which quote-unquote minimalists I'm really drawn to and which ones maybe I'm really not. Has a lot to do with light, has a lot to do with space, has a lot to do with how the spectator moves through the space. and an invitation to do so. So McCracken, you have to move around it. You can't just stand there. Actually, it won't allow you to.
Right.
It will not permit it. And that, I relate to that immensely.
When you say it won't permit you not to just stand there, what do you mean?
Okay, well, maybe I'm saying more about me than I should, but I just think if I stood in front of a Kraken plank and I just stood in front of it, the only reason to just stand in front of it is to look at myself. And there's more that it's demanding. Does that make sense?
I've almost got you on figurative. All right. I'm going to read something that came across my desk literally yesterday. A friend of mine is processing someone's collection who had a lot of McCracken and found in this collection an unpublished 1974 manuscript where John McCracken is writing about not making color planks, but making black planks. And I thought I would just read some passages from it, just because it's great. Tonight, parentheses, party at Knudsen's, thought again of black planks, their absolute, negative, absorptive things. Moving to color, multiple color planks, may be a step down from my real bag, bag is in quotes. Maybe I'm hesitant about doing a show of black planks because I'm underestimating my potential audience. Maybe I don't think they could, quote, see the pure black pieces. What's wrong with me? The worst thing I could do is to underestimate people in that way. All that can lead to is the sad state of playing to people's worst sides. And that's no good. That's the opposite of what I want to do. So I know, I had a real wow moment there too. His capacity to stay with his bad idea and understand it and understand his own implication, you know, how he was being implicated there. And then he goes, funny, the idea of all black pieces, frightening idea, depressing idea, exciting idea, interesting idea, fascinating idea, open-ended idea. The color pieces wouldn't be so open-ended, would they? They'd be particular things, not so open-ended, not so inviting, of deep projecting, reflecting, going on into ... black, pure deep black, like deep space, like pure nothingness, like empty fullness, etc. And I was like, is John McCracken an Afrofuturist? But that could be a description of one of your installations.
Except that I'm enacting culture and not color. Well, or all the colors, which black is, I guess. So.
Right.
But I mean, the way he arrived at the inevitability of blackness, I think about all the time.
Mm-hmm. And when you say that inevitability, what does that mean for you?
On an optical level, that it's the color that absorbs all the other colors. On a cultural level, anti-blackness is the one sort of like practice globally that seems to be irresolvable and wholly enforced. And I don't see any solution to almost any problems we have because there's this way in which it's tethered to all other relations. And the practice of anti-blackness, or the enforcement of it, all other relations with all things, the planet, living things, materials. And without resolving that, I think about this all the time, and it's impossible to put it into an artwork, so I ramble like this, but I think about that. He's thinking about the color, and I also think he is, as a lot of white people do, kind of like avoidant of attaching that color to a social political reality.
Yeah.
But then he does approach it anyway. That's why I want the paper, because he's trying so hard to move past his own avoidance and approach it so that he can make his work and make it true to him. And I think that that's like, as a teacher, maybe something I've never really heard an artist sort of like walk themselves towards something that they were so scared of.
Yeah, I found it really extraordinary too, that sense that I think you're right, because what he can't abide in himself is the moment when he realizes I would be talking down to my audience. Like that moment of internal rigor around his own practice, and to understand the object is an offering to another. And if you don't meet the other as your equal, then the gig is up.
That's the ethic that you were talking about earlier.
Right. It's the magic hour. And I'm so happy that you all came and participated in this live taping of Dialogues. I'm really, really immensely grateful to Colleen and Michael for showing up and for having such interesting things to say. And thank you all. Thanks so much.
Dialogues is produced by David Zwirner. If you like this episode, please follow, rate, and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. It really does help the show. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you join us here next time.